through the circle form. The two lasers can be moved, so that the propulsive power can be used in any direction from the horizontal plane. I understand it so far, but you must need an awful lot of fuel in order to continually allow material to escape. That is the secret of the universal spaceship. No matter is lost in the propulsion process. The matter blasted backwards vanishes but stays as an overdose of immaterial energy of the cosmic carrier field in a complicated power field within the spaceship. Because of this, we can create new matter within a fraction of a second, which is again introduced and accelerated. The process repeats itself as an endless cycle. Through the disappearance of from above the matter, the movement energy is lost, which is to say that it is changed into a reaction-free force, but the mass energy is retained. You've lost me. You can really create reaction-free forces in a closed circuit. How is that possible? I always thought that the law of action-reaction was correct. That law is indeed correct. And in order to overcome the law you must overcome natural laws, or, in other words, the cosmic carrier field laws. Are you not afraid that with this information we could construct a sun wheel? No. The cardinal point. The reversal of the matter-energy carrier field transformations, defying the laws of nature, demands such a high standard of advanced atomic science that you will no longer be able to reach it. Energy surplus overstressed from the carrier field, which can create matter particles, is an extremely dangerous phenomenon. Such unimaginable concentration of energy can only be controlled in gravitational fields of which even the most elementary knowledge is absent here on Earth. Such a sun wheel radiates a force that even over long distances can cause certain electron movements to cease and metal constructions to disintegrate. You have no idea of the technique that goes into building universal spacecraft. Why do you call it a sun wheel? What has it got to do with the sun? Suns, due to the rotation of their critical mass, a natural spacecraft which, under the influence of the particle bombardment of their neighbors, navigate space with free cosmic vector powers. Through these powers they maintain their distance from other stars and cause the turning moment and the expansion of galaxies. The sun wheel, therefore, is a copy of the power of a sun. A sun wheel can exert power only in the horizontal plane and one alone can, therefore, not navigate. It is necessary to place a smaller wheel beside the main central wheel, on both sides, that of the landing units, so that a torque can be created in order to steer the ship. When this wing system is covered by metal plating, the discus form appears naturally. Why do they have to be so streamlined, since space is surely empty? We wish that were true. For spaceships that travel at relative speeds, space is not empty enough and not only streamlining but armor plating is also necessary. You have seen our ship and can see that armor is not a useless luxury. They have no windows, they are heavy, armored projectiles, whose strength comes from the discus form. Comment, other cosmic races Grex. Pleiadians from planet Terra, Sanjays, seems to have developed a system with magnetic protection shields, which apparently serve the same purpose as here described. But it seems as these beings, Eargons don't travel into them through jumps in hyperspace, as the Aerostiv describes. And because of that, their space travel seems to take very long time as will be said later in the text. In earlier times the Pleiadians, our ancestors from the system of Lyra, also had these first generation space travels, then the trips took very long time. Rune remark, when our radar warns us of dust or material, we make the banking maneuver that you have just seen. This then presents the smallest possible surface area to the danger. Nevertheless, each particle of dust makes burn marks on the plating. For this reason we always fly in line formation. The command consists of 5 ships and the lead ship is always unmanned, because this one runs the greatest risk. The ships are connected by a cable, because at relative speeds radio contact is impossible. Another advantage of the discus form is the great natural resistance to thermal variations and the large cooling surface. The ships are very hot under normal working conditions and the outer plating acts as a cooler for control of the energy processes on board. Lastly, the discus form is ideal for creating a strong magnetic field that protects the occupants from dangerous radiation in space. We hope your question is answered. Yes, fine, thank you, but didn't you say something about a protective weapon which you could use if material threatened to cross the path of the spacecraft? The antimatter ray, STAR, is a defense against larger blocks which only rarely occur in space. The use of this ray demands not only enormous quantities of energy, but it is controlled by strong restrictions to prevent disturbing the natural balance. We are only justified in its use when no other methods are possible. This weapon cannot replace the armor plating of our ships. I understand. What is life like on board in weightless conditions? It seems to me that it must not be very pleasant. In weightless conditions, it would indeed not only not be pleasant, it would even be impossible. An intelligent being cannot live without gravity during the endless journey between the stars. We have solved this problem by the continual use of the sun wheel, which creates a constant acceleration or deceleration exactly like the conditions on our planet. We do not subject our people to abnormal gravity forces. The acceleration of our ships is always constant so that we can live on board exactly as in our homes. The journey begins with a long period of acceleration until we have reached the maximum speed at which navigation is possible. Then we alternately slow down and speed up. The last part of the journey is a long period of deceleration. Gravity is always normal, because of the continual working of the great, central sun wheel. The small sun wheels are not used for normal propulsion. Again, other Cosmos races Rex. Pleiadians from planet Terra, Sanjays, have developed a system which creates an artificial gravitational field, where all atoms, in people aboard, are affected of the same progressive forces as of the ship. Agdoto. What is above and below with you on board? The screen again showed the view of the four ships in line formation joined by the cable. You see here the formation of our command shortly after leaving our planet. The acceleration was in the direction of light and the ships flew to the left. The left ship is therefore above the right one, where the navigation dome is out, is below. So you are standing upright in the area that is horizontal in the picture. I see you then on your side. Exactly. I stared into the navigation dome and suddenly I understood. I see this navigation dome is normally vertical, which explains why all the instruments are on the floor. The metal grills are the floor levels for using the instruments and the track in the middle is for a lift to bring you to the different levels. We have no complaints about your powers of observation. Is the control of such a machine so complicated that all these instruments are necessary? The control of the ship does not require all these instruments. They are for other purposes. To explain it, we must begin at the beginning. This landing unit is a part of the huge mother ship. It can release itself and operate independently in space and land on planets. In the normal situation, these landing units are an integral part of the mother ship. You must realize that the central wheel of a landing unit is one of the two steering wheels of the mother ship. We will show you a landing unit in action and then you will understand better. The view changed. Right in front of me was a huge discus. I saw only the upper surface, pockmarked with burns and melted stone masses. Then, slowly, out of this monster, rose a tiny black pole that I recognized as the black pole approximately 5 feet in diameter. Then appeared the shining rim of the navigation dome. Immediately after, a small discus rose out of the middle of the spaceship as though it was forcefully pushed away. The thing accelerated and disappeared as a speck of light in the background of stars. It was an asymmetrical discus of much smaller dimensions. Its upper surface matched the curve of the mothership perfectly, but the underside was more rounded and it had a conical rim. Also on the underside was a further thickening in the form of a flat dome. The mothership was left with a deep bowl in the middle, in which the landing unit fitted. Is the landing unit's navigation dome as big as this? Yes. Good heavens, then the unit must be at least 250 feet in diameter. That is nearly correct. Inconceivable. Exactly. The technical know-how that goes into the building of a universal spacecraft is beyond the conception of Earthmen. This navigation dome is the nerve center of the spaceship. Imagine what is involved in navigation and communication, what is needed only in instruments, data records and calculating machines. Each navigation dome can carry out all the control functions of the entire fleet, including climate control, food production, entertainment and the study program for the children. All in all, too much to mention, but we can assure you that the number of instruments is kept to an absolute minimum. Exactly. The technical know-how that goes into the building of a universal spacecraft is beyond the conception of Earthmen. This navigation dome is the nerve center of the spaceship. Imagine what is involved in navigation and communication, what is needed only in instruments, data records and calculating machines. Each navigation dome can carry out all the control functions of the entire fleet, including climate control, food production, entertainment and the study program for the children. All in all, too much to mention, but we can assure you that the number of instruments is kept to an absolute minimum. What did you say? Study programs for the children? Do you have children on board? Yes, we are not just an expedition. We live on board with our wives and children, sometimes for 20 years or more. Space is our home. For people seeking contemplation as the greatest happiness, the warm intimate contact is a life experience and a mental enrichment that we would not miss for anything. You could compare us to your monks. We wish to live and die among the stars. Yes, you must be rather like monks if you lead your lives in a steel box. You have no idea of the comfort on board our ships, but we will leave it to that. How long can you keep the sun wheel constantly in motion? Long time, even up to 20 years, then we must refuel. So you must make sure that you are back on your own planet within that time? No, our fuel is water. The oxygen is used for ourselves and the hydrogen is our source of energy. Many solar systems have a wet planet and this is usually the goal of our journey, so finding water is no problem. Our landing units are fitted out for the efforts to publish transportation of water. This is how they are able to remain underwater like your submarines. So you only take water on board? That is so. Then what do you eat over all the years? This is one of the main problems involved with the construction of universal spaceships. The technique is only half the problem. The other half is making a livable environment on board with a 100% recycling system. It is difficult to keep intelligent beings alive under space conditions. We can give you no more information about our spacecraft. This was more than enough and we have reached the end of our talk. If you wish to ask anything special, this is your last chance. You surely cannot leave without giving me instructions as to how I am to publish this conversation. Do not expect us to give you instructions, you are free to do as you will, our work is done. The knowledge has been planted, and even if you should decide to do nothing, it has also been planted in the collective consciousness of man, of which you have the knowledge. Millions of the departed have listened with you, they know as well as you do. I don't understand, on the one hand you impress upon me the importance of this information to humanity at the end of time, and on the other hand you tell me that I am free to publish or not, I can't make head or tail of this. The first law of interplanetary contacts is that the free will of a cosmic race may never be infringed. Pure knowledge does not infringe the freedom unless we are dealing with a race that has not yet made its choice, as we are here. Let us begin with the first observation, knowledge does not infringe freedom. This means that we are permitted to plant knowledge, and nothing more than that. We may never exert any kind of pressure to make you do anything with this knowledge. This is why we tell you that the knowledge is planted in the collective consciousness of man. Sooner or later it must come to the surface. You have no obligations at all, you are free. The second observation causes greater problems. Knowledge can influence the freedom of choice of an ignorant race, as we have already explained, and certainly when this knowledge is presented with authority, or by one means or the other, It can be made indisputable, but you must never try to prove our existence, and the proof of the existence of God may only be used when all other efforts to publish have failed. You can rest assured that I would hate myself if I did not publish this knowledge. I assume that you could still give me some advice when I am ready to publish. When it is obvious that you have chosen of your own free will, we will be prepared to give you a few hints. The first thing you must do is to control the impact of your publication to prevent hysteria and fanaticism. You can only accomplish this by being mysterious about the source of your information. We know that you have made photos of our navigation dome and you must destroy them. The block of metal which we offered you at the beginning of our conversation cannot be given anymore. If, however, you do manage to find some proof of our existence, things will get out of hand and you will be destroyed by the hysteria of mankind. Write your book in clear science fiction style and bring in certain, so that it cannot be used as irrefutable logic. You must leave people free to believe or not, as they choose. If anyone should ask you if it really happened, you must deny it and say that it is pure imagination. The people for whom the book is destined will say, "I'm not interested whether it really happened or not. For me, it is true. It has changed my insight and now I live consciously. I know the meaning behind life." Honesty is dangerous for you and no measure in interplanetary contacts. Therefore, you must not publish all the information in one shot, but step by step and measure the results. Never strive to be believed. Your duty is only to publish this information and nothing more. Let the books lead their own lives and avoid publicity stunts. They will then pass from hand to hand and reach the people for whom they are intended. Ensure that they are published in a sufficient number of languages and use the income from the book to this end. Make sure that it is available at the end time when people will begin to ask for it. Never try to convince people of the truth in the book if they are not right for it, or if they are unable to understand it. Never bring pressure to bear on your surroundings, for that will only create panic and hysteria. Remain modest. Answer questions only from people who have for the most part understood the book and accepted it. Never say anything in conflict with the Christ insight such as it appears in the Bible. His authority is unassailable in the whole universe. He is the only way, the only truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through him, means, his way of living, forgiving everything you feel as injustice against you. Our conversation is over. It is late and you must reach the harbor before dark. We are going to say our goodbyes. Are you ready to leave? A feeling of despair began to come over me, mixed with a strange emotion. They were leaving, they were going to leave me alone. There were a great many more questions to ask, and who was going to help me when they were gone? I rose slowly and walked to the window so that I could see these 8 space travelers once more at dose range. Yes, we must say goodbye. I shall miss you terribly. There is so much more to ask and to be explained, but what I shall miss most is your interest and affection for us. The pleasant warmth that you call unselfishness. I will never be able to explain what this contact with you has done to me. It has in a short time made another man of me, with a wider horizon and a deeper insight. It has made me a man with purpose, and I have received a commission which must be carried out. I will accept the challenge. Greet the people on Iaga and the other planets for me, and thank them for their part in this journey of yours that has made all this possible. Tell them that this man envies them their world of perfection, where intelligent people can really be happy. Tell them that I understand, in spite of the questions that have not yet been answered. And now it is my difficult task to thank you all for. Stop, Steph. You do not have to thank us. Our satisfaction in the fact that you have accepted the challenge makes thanks unnecessary, but there is still one big problem. You know how we worry that you will try to prove our existence and this would mean that we had gone too far. You can relieve us of a great burden by promising to destroy the film and refraining from any attempt to collect proof. I smiled, a little regretfully. I have even understood and accepted the ethics of interplanetary contacts. I assure you on my word of honor that I will destroy the film and refrain from trying to collect any kind of proof. The disinterested attitude of the 8 suddenly changed. They got up and came to stand in a half circle around the window. For the first time, I saw some kind of emotional reaction on their faces. You have taken a great weight off our minds. We trust your honesty and you have therefore made it possible for us to allow you to leave unhindered with all your knowledge. Only now do we feel justified in doing this. Operation Cosmic Integration Earth is a success. A heavy burden has been lifted from us. We rely on you to understand that it is our duty to convince ourselves that you have destroyed the film, and we ask you to do so before you step on board your ship, and daily within sight of the Black Pole. Thereafter, we will let your ship loose, and leave. Farewell, Stiff, and we wish you the courage to trust. May the inspiration of the Spirit of Truth accompany you on your journey. Farewell. Above my head the hatch opened. The eight creatures made a respectful bow with one hand held against their foreheads. I returned the greeting in the same manner. Farewell, a thousand thanks. A while later, Miriam and the children stood wide-eyed to observe the sight of a man with a thoughtful expression who stood up to his knees in the water and opened a camera. He then pulled the film out and threw it in the water. He then waved in the direction of the Black Pole as a last greeting, and climbed on board. It was a beautiful, windless evening and we all stood on board waiting and wondering what was going to happen. For the last time we heard the zooming noise as the navigation dome retracted, but this time the intricately formed Black Pole remained extended. Shortly afterwards, a dull shock went through the ship, as the astronauts released us and the ship floated once again in its element. We started drifting with the tide and we could hear the anchor chain scraping over the surface of the spaceship until it reached the edge, then the anchor fell and the chain jerked tight. As I began to wind up the chain, I heard the propulsion system of the spaceship start working and the Black Pole began moving through the water, seaward. I stood watching from the foredeck and was surprised when I noticed how slowly they were traveling. It could not have been more than 6 or 7 knots. It suddenly came to me that perhaps they did not dare to go any faster with the huge discus in this water, which was full of sandbanks and shallows, and at the same time the idea occurred to me that I could perhaps follow them for a while and might even be able to see something of the takeoff. I ran aft and quickly started the motor and followed the broad form wake at full power, despite the protests of Miriam, who could not see the glamour of this new adventure. In half an hour we had left the coast of the inlands of Walcherian and Suwin behind us and were on the open sea. The sun had set in a beautiful red glow and the still dark water swirled slowly. It had been a strange voyage. The complete loneliness, the wide expanse of water, and, mostly, the presence of the strange machine put a pressure on all of us against which my stubbornness was no match. As soon as I lost sight of the wake left by the spaceship, I stopped the motor and left the ship to float on its own while we all had a cup of coffee. In this complete stillness we sat on deck, tense and listening. Just as I had decided to give up and return to harbor, we heard the jangling sound of the propulsion in the distance. I jumped up, put the binoculars before my eyes and began feverishly scanning the water. Miriam saw it first. There, Stiff, a light. Through the binoculars I saw a huge disc that, with a swaying motion, rose out of the water. The light was caused by a sparkling halo that spread over the whole visible surface of the spaceship. Close to the water it was yellow-orange, further up yellow-green and on top blue, and thanks to this lighting effect, I was able to see the discus quite plainly despite the distance. Suddenly the noise and the intensity of the light increased. Some few seconds later the machine disappeared in a huge cloud of steam. Shortly thereafter, it appeared again above the cloud, a huge glowing discus that rose at a steep angle in the form of a spiral with our ship at its middle point. The sight was much more impressive than the films I had seen of space. Actually, there was very little of the discus to be seen. It was surrounded by an orange-red cloud that prevented a clear view. Around this cloud hung a huge misty halo which made the spaceship look bigger than it really was. The fiery light caused a cry of alarm to come from Miriam. She thought that something had gone wrong, but I was able to reassure her. It is quite normal. Things glow with heat when the propulsion is working. We stood breathlessly looking at this unearthly, indescribably impressive show of power from these beings, who, as a final gesture, flew in a huge circle round our ship, then rapidly dwindled to a tiny point of red light that was soon lost in the darkness of the evening sky. Despite my triumphant feeling that I had succeeded in seeing the takeoff, I felt strangely lonely, the sort of feeling that comes after saying goodbye to a good and trusted friend. Miriam seemed to share something of my feelings, for she came and stood beside me and put her arm through mine. We again heard the screaming whine of the propulsion, and to our surprise another discus rose out of the water in the same place. We witnessed the same display of sparks and the steam cloud, only this time it did not fly in a spiral, but went straight up like a rocket. "Good heavens," whispered Miriam, "another one of those monsters. How many of them are there? Please, let's go. If another one goes off, I shall scream." I did not answer. I stood as if in a trance, staring at the point of light until it had disappeared into the night. For some minutes we stood still on the swaying deck, hoping or fearing that perhaps a third would take off, but nothing more happened. Suddenly Miriam gave a cry. "There, Steph, there they go." High in the dark sky, a speck of light had appeared. The first of the machines had broken free of the Earth's shadow and flew in the light of the sinking sun. Through the binoculars I saw a misty object that gave off an orange glow and was surrounded by a misty halo. This was followed shortly by the second one. Quite suddenly the halos vanished, and they were seemingly free of the atmosphere and proceeded as two cigar-shaped objects that were slowly swallowed up in the endlessness of space. I lay her head on my shoulder. "So, have you finished?" I sighed and put my arm around her. "No, dear. They—" and I pointed to the place where they had vanished, "they are finished, but for us it has just begun. Text the craft drawing, sectioned view of a space discus. The discus form of the mothership, which is approximately 250 meters in diameter, is a compromise between a maximum surface area for cooling and a minimum frontal area with a maximum capacity. This is the universal solution for space travel at cosmic velocities. The power source, a sun wheel, two opposed cyclotrons with an outer ring from the control of weightless energy, is unknown to US and demands the circular planform. The danger of collision with cosmic dust at relative speeds necessitates the smallest possible frontal area. The two smaller modular disks are in fact landing units. The mothership always remains in space. Electromagnetic fields, high temperatures, and the ionization of the surrounding air make it impossible for us to see these craft in clear detail. A race that can finance such machines is by axiom peaceful. They need global cooperation before it is possible. Text for painting image of Argon City, page 102-103 in the book. The dwelling units, great covered rings, over 900 feet in diameter by nearly 300 feet high, housed about 10,000 people per unit, and included all services and facilities of all kinds for that many individuals. They were arranged in rectangular formations of 36 ring complexes per city, giving a population density of about 6,000 per square kilometer. The strange vegetation has evolved to withstand the heavy gravity and the high winds that prevail here. With only a 10% land surface available on this planet, high-density living became a necessity and developed efficiently. The strange vegetation has evolved to withstand the heavy gravity and the high winds that prevail here. The fully automated robot rail transport system operated with frictionless efficiency, moving vehicles of many sizes and configurations at high speeds. There were individual cars for small groups, collective units like trains for mass movement, cargo units for commerce, and even a peculiar development something like a hotel tram. A group of people wanting to travel together would order a unit that was fitted out as a self-service hotel and simply go where the mood took them. The system was marvelously efficient and could move over 1 million persons per hour past any point using only the upper six-lane rail system between the house blocks. The rail system and equipment was designed with a useful life expectancy of 1,000 years, a kind of quality undreamed of on Earth. text for UFO painting, painting of an Eargon exploration leaving the ringed home planet on an interstellar journey. An exploration command frequently consists of 5,000-foot diameter universal spacecraft powered by sun wheels. They fly in line astern formation connected by an umbilical. One of the two 250-foot detachable landing modules may be seen in the center of each of the larger excursion vessels. Painting by Jim Nichols. Publisher's note, the exact date and time of this first contact event are in fact known, as well as other evidential support. There are other witnesses and there is material evidence supporting this story, but in keeping with the contactee's solemn promise never to try to prove the reality of the story or the actual existence of the Eargons, for very good reason, we have chosen not to reveal it. When Del C. Stevens, Part 2 on Philosophy is not yet as audiobook like these appendixes. Understanding Time. Other Cosmic Races. There are a YouTube video on how Native found communicating signals seemingly coming from the Eargon team. Then search for Eargon on YouTube.